Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. We had a big weekend of sports. The Daytona 500, the NBA All-Star Game, the Winter Olympics. I could have started anywhere at all. And then Fergie absolutely murdered the national anthem. Bubba Watson was the big winner this weekend. Bubba Watson was the big winner this weekend at Riviera. Hawk was the big loser after Rory McIlroy absolutely clowned him after a sad high-five attempt. And just days after Mets skipper Mickey Callaway said that he was done with dry humping, GM Sandy Alderson got in on the act himself. Our three guests brought it. Ben Golver came in and broke down the All-Star game. Astros manager A.J. Hinch gave us an update from spring training. And the New York Times national baseball writer Tyler Kepner got us ready for the baseball season and broke down what's going on with Derek Jeter and the Marlins. The Daily Jungle starts right now. The pregame intros, cringy and awkward. But that and everything in between, you have to admit, and if I'm starting with this and not the game, and the game had a great ending, all of that paled in comparison to what Fergie did to our national anthem. Now, to be fair, I am not a singer. I am not a professional musician. I certainly have been awkward and cringy. But although I'm none of those two other things, a professional singer or a musician, I do have a couple of working ears. That is not your hint or sign to talk about the commissioner. Because I know you clones better than you know you clones, and I know what you think before you think it. I'm talking about the national anthem and Fergie's rendition and the fact that I do have a couple of working ears and now about 10 shattered windows after this rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. After it ripped through my living room. Listen, I understand we all live in a society of snap takes where everybody can't wait to call something the best ever or the worst ever. And typically, whatever gets that gloss just becomes something that we forget about in about 10 minutes. Oh yeah, that's the best thing ever. Forgotten about. That's the worst thing I've ever seen or heard. You know, out of sight, out of mind, 1 hour later. So let me go on record with this right now. That was pretty much the worst national anthem ever. And I'm not going to forget about that. Not in an hour, not in a day, not in a week, not ever. Worst ever. Worse than Carl Lewis, who until now was destined to be the GOAT. I mean, Carl Lewis, his rendition was slapped up on a piece of wood, laminated, thrown up on a wall, and never, ever, ever coming down. This was even worse than Roseanne, who was clearly on troll level infinity with her version. This was worse than Stapp, who was born as Stapp, and he had no choice but to go full Stapp with his.
Oh, the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming.
Uh-oh! But Fergie's was so freaking bad because Fergie thought that hers was so freaking good. In case you missed it, let me play back just some of it right here. And for the sake of time and our collective sanity, I have isolated the most memorable parts. Here's how it starts.
Oh, say, can you see?
I mean, did Marilyn Monroe just jump out of a birthday cake? Or is somebody singing the national anthem? It's impossible to tell. But painfully obvious that we were in for the awkward, wannabe sexy, jazzy, lounge version of the anthem. Which is a version that I didn't even know existed. I mean, was she trying to seduce the entire country with that? I actually thought about reaching for some protection for the rest of her effort, only to realize it really wasn't hot. Not hot at all. Let's continue.
What's so proudly wave at the twilight? broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight.
Yeah, I see you working, Draymond. We all see you working, Draymond. Couple things. First is, who is playing stand-up bass? That's an instrument that I thought that I would never see or hear at a basketball game. A stand-up bass for the anthem. Billie Holiday crooning to stand-up bass? Sure. Ella Fitzgerald? Absolutely. But Fergie laying down a vocal track over a stand-up bass? The hell is going on right now? Which brings me to my second point. I stopped the anthem right as cameras caught LeBron and Chance the Rapper trying to hold back laughter. Legitimately trying to stop from busting up. Keep in mind that as we move forward, because they were not the only ones who were trying to hold this thing together. Here's more. You just heard that. That was real. Dr. Alvin DeLauro did not perform audio surgery on that clip. That was real. I wish it wasn't, but that was. I also wish I knew the name of the broadcast director who captured that dumbfounded Draymond Green who just started cracking up, because that's about to become the gif of the decade. Because we were all Draymond Green last night. And he was all of us. Dude's jaw was on the floor. Until a... way, hey, 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 way, hey, hey, of laughter washed over him. But if you know that song, which we all do, you also know, unfortunately and tragically, that song was not yet over.
For the land.
Yeah, what do you say? Let's just do anything besides what we just did.
Let's play some basketball!
Let's just get in a time machine and pretend that never happened.
Let's play some basketball!
Let's arrest Fergie for murder in the first degree of the national anthem.
Let's play some basketball!
God, you know, she walked off like, I guarantee she went to one of her handlers like, yeah, how'd that go? How'd that go? You know, where's your phone? I need your phone. Can I borrow your phone? I have a couple of calls I need to make. Yeah, but how'd I do? Give me your phone. Give me your phone. Whatever you do, do not look at your phone. I mean, again, I have no idea who greenlit this rendition, because someone somewhere had to have heard her practice this version. There had to have been a sound check. There had to have been a rehearsal. There had to have been a person who was saying, hey, Fergie, I've got a couple of notes on this. And if not, then why? I mean, did she go out there without rehearsing it? Why? Because they were concerned they might lose her? Oh, no, no, no. She doesn't want to rehearse. Because whoever that person is who allowed her to take center court and allowed her to do that should be held accountable. Because there is no reason anyone anywhere should have had to have heard that. Because now we can't unhear it. How do I know it was that bad? Because 90 minutes after the fact, Charles Barkley could not wait to talk about it.
Can we talk about Fergie's national anthem? Oh, stop. Don't do that. Don't do that to my Fergie. Leave her alone. Fergie, I love you. It was different. It was sexy. I like
it. Damn right it was different.
Leave her alone.
I needed a cigarette after that.
Leave her alone.
Chuck's so great. Shaq's like, it was different. Fergie, I love you. It's all good, Fergie. It was different. Damn right it was different. I need a cigarette after that. Chuck, I need a heater. I need a vape. I need a dip. I need a stogie. I do need protection. All the above. I so badly wish that last night was all about that game, because the game, for the first time in a long time, was actually decent. It was watchable. But Fergie went wire to wire with her Yoko take on the anthem, and for all the wrong reasons. And was still trending on Twitter for it this morning. And not only still trending on Twitter for it this morning, but trending twice on Twitter for it this morning. Two different topics. That's how bad that was. As the great Randy Jackson once said, "Yeah, that's going to be a no for me, dog. Clones, can I have one moment so I can talk to you about stamps.com? It goes without saying that the U.S. Postal Service is an important tool for any business reaching every household every single day. Now, stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. You can print postage for any mail class right from your own computer, with the exact amount of postage every single time, so you never underpay or overpay. And Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. I love Stamps.com, and the reason I use Stamps.com is because it is convenient, it is easy, it is reliable, it is so efficient, it saves me so much time. I love this product. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. So go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in jungle. To get this deal, go to stamps.com and enter the code name jungle. I love this product. I know you will too. That's stamps.com. Now it's back to our daily jungle. Ben Golliver is my guest. Ben, great to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. I heard you like that national anthem last night. Your producers were telling me.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was awesome, Ben. How did you have that thing scored?
Well, I'll tell you this much. I was there pregame about an hour and a half early when she was going through the sound check, and I knew it was going to be a problem because she kept going back to the microphone interference in my ear. I need this change. I need this change. And it sounded terrible 2 hours before the show. They get into the show. It wasn't any better. You know, the dunk contest, they go from like a scale of 30 to 50. I'd probably give her a 32, you know, just a few generous points below the or above the minimum. But it was a rough start, and thankfully the game picked up after that.
I like that. That's some good intel right now, that even in the sound check it went badly, and the game did pick up. Her performance did not, but the game did. So now that you've had a few hours to think about that game, what do you make of the NBA All-Star game for 2018, and in particular, Ben, the fourth quarter of yesterday's game?
Well, the big takeaway is this. We were screaming for months about, oh, it's going to be captains now, Team LeBron, Team Steph. Are they going to televise the draft? I mean, there's just all this noise around the event. But none of that, to me, necessarily mattered as much as the simple fact they decided to play hard. You know, these last 2 years have been an abomination. You know, 2016, 2017, the guys are just going out there jogging, allowing free dunks. And, you know, I wrote it in 2016. I wrote it again in 2017. And, you know, thankfully, I think the players came to an understanding that it's not in the league's best interest. It's not in their best interest if they don't take the All-Star game more seriously. So I actually give, you know, credit to LeBron James. You know, he did that interview, you know, coming into All-Star weekend with Kevin Durant, where they said they were going to try to lead the charge and get more serious on the court. When I saw that, I kind of chuckled and thought, okay, sure, LeBron, you know, there's going to be a lot of parties on Saturday night. Don't overpromise here. But the fact is, in crunch time, LeBron was everywhere. I mean, the unbelievable passing sequence for the layup, the crazy step back three over Joel Embiid, the great defensive stop on Steph Curry down the stretch in the last play of the game. I mean, these are almost playoff type moments in this midseason showcase. That's not what we've seen in recent years. And for that reason, I give the players a lot of credit. They decided to take it more seriously this year, and it really improved the product.
We're talking to Ben Golliver. So, Ben, the question is why? I mean, was it the different format? Was it the prize money? Was it pride? Was it something altogether different? Why was it different this year?
Yeah, I think, first of all, there was a lot of planning involved. Adam Silver, Chris Paul were sitting down months ago talking about this. I think also the buildup in terms of, you know, the captain formats and just changing things up, you know, doing it differently, probably reset expectations in terms of what guys are thinking going into that game. And let's be honest, like, even for a media schlub like me, you know, the All-Star weekend is exhausting. I mean, you're running around all over the city. The last thing I could imagine doing on a Sunday night is going up and down the court for 48 minutes. I mean, you're just exhausted by all the events and the late night stuff too. So I think it was really just a resetting of expectations from the players union, from the league, about making sure that the showcase game actually puts the league in the best light. You know, Kevin Durant made a comment that he didn't want the All-Star game to be viewed as a joke anymore. I think that was dead on. And, you know, that doesn't mean you can't have fun. You know, early on in the game, you're seeing some sloppy turnovers, you're seeing some alley-oops and all that. But things really tightened up down the stretch, and you saw some great plays. I mean, guys like Joel Embiid, I thought he really made a big mark late in that game, kind of giving Philadelphia fans maybe a playoff preview. You saw the swarming defense from Kevin Durant and LeBron on Steph Curry. You know, you saw a little hero ball attempt from a guy like James Harden. I mean, this is really what we're coming to see, right? We want to see the best players going at each other. And for the first time in years, we got that.
Ben Golver is the host of the Open Floor podcast, among other things. Hey, Ben, one more thought about the end of the game. When Team LeBron was up by three with Stephen inbounding, was there any part of you thinking they should foul with a three-point lead? And then was there any part of you thinking, wait a minute, am I seriously talking about a foul strategy in an All-Star game?
Not only was I thinking it, I was shouting it out in the media room, trying to get people on my side. No, it's right. A true sign of a basketball degeneracy when you're, like, strategizing the late-game stuff during the All-Star game. But it wasn't just that. You know, Joel Embiid gets taken off the court for a little bit, and we're sitting there wondering, like, what's Mike D'Antoni doing? We're questioning the referees. There was even, you know, there was that controversy over the ball going out of bounds. I mean, it really was not your typical All-Star game there late. It had all the layers that you want from a truly competitive game. And so, and that's why I keep going back to the main takeaway going forward here for, like, next year and beyond. We don't need to have some crazy process or new captains or some gigantic TV show blowout as long as the guys play hard. If they play hard late in that fourth quarter, it's going to be a good show. And that's the most important takeaway from Sunday night.
You know, watching LeBron play the way he did, very clearly it's still his league. And then there's what happened off the floor. There's how he played yesterday, and then there's how he dealt with that, quote, shut up and dribble comment. What do you make of how LeBron handled the entire weekend?
Well, I thought I knew he was going to come strong on Saturday. There was no doubt because of the buildup and the back and forth on Twitter. He was very thoughtful. He had extended comments. He made lots of really good points. He was also kind of like a masterclass in shade. Like, he was pointing out that, you know, he thought maybe she was reading off a teleprompter and she had gotten her facts wrong because she said he didn't graduate from high school. So he was kind of like dropping all these little darts at her as he was going through, you know, some really compelling commentary in terms of where he stands in the world as an inspiration for young fans. And I think, you know, if you have kids out there, you know, if you're a listener or, you know, if you're a teenager or whatever, I'd encourage everybody to just go listen to what he said, because I thought it was very thoughtful. It didn't devolve into sort of personal attacks like it could have. He's trying to take the high road on this stuff. And it's a tough spot, Jim, because what's Adam Silver really supposed to do, right? Adam Silver's in the position as the NBA commissioner where he has to sort of tap dance, you know, balance a lot of interests, you know, not try to get into a shouting war with the president of the United States. And so guys like LeBron James and Kevin Durant are out there just taking all the arrows sort of by themselves and standing up for themselves. One other thing I did like, though, was the Players Association came through and really had their back, a pretty strong statement against the Fox News host. And I think for that reason, it was nice to see the players kind of get that support on that level because, you know, these are delicate issues. You know, the last thing any league wants, especially once they've seen how the NFL has sort of been treated here over the last 6 months, kind of in the political climate, the NBA does not want to be the NFL part two. And I think LeBron's doing a pretty nice job of steering this ship the correct direction.
Ben Golver joining us back in the jungle once again. I'm trying not to make this all about LeBron, but another thing about LeBron, Ben, he said after the game, quote, L.A. is built for stars, end quote. Now, we know that LeBron can be cryptic at times, especially on social. I know what Laker fans would like to read into that comment. How did you interpret that comment?
Well, every year you get the nice comments about the host city, right? The generic nice comment. Even in Toronto when it was like negative 40 degrees out there, people were like, oh, great host city, great international vibe. We loved it. LeBron went on a lot longer than he needed to with his praise of L.A. I mean, he was breaking down traffic patterns. He was saying how it's built for startup and success. I mean, it was really quite the long ode to Los Angeles. So, I mean, I don't know if he's just kind of ramping up, you know, the free agency speculation, just trying to get people to remember that, hey, he still is the best player. He's going to be the most coveted guy this summer, and he's going to have his options. I mean, all these teams are going to be coming after him, whether it's Houston, San Antonio, the Lakers, the Clippers, they're all going to want a piece of him. And of course, Cleveland did everything they possibly could at the trade deadline to convince him to stay with the moves that they made. So I think he likes to, you know, toy with people, but I definitely believe he knew exactly what he was doing when he said, you know, L.A. is built for stars. I mean, you know, that is a shout-out to Lakers Nation if I've ever heard one.
Ben Golver, my guest. Speaking of Los Angeles, you recently had a piece, Ben, on Victor Solomon. Who is Victor Solomon, and how did he become known in NBA circles?
Well, it's a deep cut, Jim. I'm impressed. This guy is a true artist. You know, he lives in East L.A. He devotes 200 hours to every project that he does. He's building stained glass backboards that are basically blinged out, and he's got himself a nice niche. It's sort of like, you know, Jason of Beverly Hills or Jacob the Jeweler, the guys who are outfitting rappers and NBA players. So this guy is sort of blinging basketball hoops. And so the Celtics got one for Paul Pierce as part of his jersey retirement. Nike got one for Kevin Durant a couple of years ago when he, you know, went up to the Bay Area right when he first got there. You know, Rick Ross has one of these basketball hoops inside his mansion next to his full court basketball court. So it's sort of a lifestyles of the rich and famous type vibe. But, you know, the craftsmanship on this work is incredible. And I was, like, really nerding out over this. I can't even lie. I was, like, calling up art historians and saying, like, hey, what do you think of this guy's materials and his process? And they're saying he's legit. I mean, he's really going piece by piece building these backboards, you know, by hand. And so it was really cool to see him, you know, have partnerships also with the Players Association. I mean, they had a bunch of gold Spalding basketball, so you almost imagine kind of stacked up in a pyramid, so it was very like this regal vibe to it. So, you know, Victor is really doing his thing out there. If anyone's interested in his art, just check out the website Literally Balling. It's got all the stuff up there.
So what's something like that cost?
A lot more than I can afford. I mean, you know, typically it's like $20,000 to $30,000 for a single piece. You know, he did a big piece for All-Star Weekend, which I'm sure was quite a bit more than that because it had four separate baskets. But, you know, it's not only the cost of the materials. Obviously, it's the cost of the time. I mean, he had to study and apprentice for a year to learn how to even make these things with some people up in San Francisco who have been doing it their entire lives. So it's like very low-tech, lo-fi, you know, type of production work. I mean, you can't just put these on an assembly line, right? And, you know, one cool idea he had, Jim, though, he wants to redo the NBA's trophies, right? He wants them to be sort of touch-activated, almost like a cell phone. So let's say you win the NBA Finals, you hold up the trophy, all of a sudden it lights up sort of like the Sword in the Stone. I mean, it's a pretty good idea. It does make you think, like, are some of these trophies boring? Are they outdated? Are they ready to be sort of, you know, technology infused? I mean, it's a minor thing, I guess, for basketball heads who care about every little detail, but it would be kind of cool to see the NBA, you know, modernize their trophies or their awards.
I like it. I think it's a great idea. One last thought, Ben, before you go. Kawhi Leonard has not played more than a month. First of all, what's his situation? And how do you explain the fact that a guy of his ability, I mean, a star, has not played more than a month and it's not a bigger story?
Look, Kawhi is always quiet, but he's been a ghost. I mean, you barely even heard, saw a picture of him, a poster of him, nothing at All-Star Weekend. And to me, the timeline or the deadline for getting him back on the court here is really soon. It's not like, oh, bring it back 1 week before the playoffs, because the Spurs are all about the chemistry, the continuity, getting guys up to speed. You know, as soon as he does come back, he's going to need that, you know, slow ramp up period to kind of get his body right. So to me, if he's not back here within like the next week or two, it's serious panic time for the Spurs. And you know, I think one question that needs to be asked is, you know, in their best case scenario, given how this season has kind of gotten away from them without Kawhi Leonard, in terms of, you know, they're not quite on that same level as Golden State and Houston. You know, I almost wonder if San Antonio is better off taking a super cautious approach this year. I just don't see their ceiling as a title team this year. I think, you know, basically one of two teams is going to win it, Golden State or Houston. And, you know, from that standpoint, you don't want to jeopardize anything with Kawhi Leonard's long-term future by trying to bring him back. You know, there was a lot of discussion maybe a month or so ago about was he happy, was he not unhappy, and, you know, hopefully the team and the player can get on the same page there. But, you know, they're running out of time. I mean, that's the simplest way to say it. If he doesn't have, like, at least a month to sort of get himself back into the swing of things, you have to wonder, like, what's the point? Why even bring him back?
So Team LeBron wins, and LeBron was named the MVP. And one thing that was very clear by the time the All-Star weekend was over is that this is still LeBron's league. He may never win another NBA title, right? But it's still his league right now. Even in his 15th season, it is still LeBron's league. As incredible as all the other stars in the association are, he stands out still above everybody else. And not just as a player, but as a leader and an ambassador. How many times did he talk about the fact that that game is watched in 200-plus countries around the world? That's not just a player talking. That's not just a great player talking. That's a businessman. That's a leader talking. Which is why it was all the more ridiculous, absurd, and really, honestly, in my opinion, downright dumb for somebody to tell LeBron to, quote, shut up and dribble. After he made comments that were critical of Donald Trump in a video with Kevin Durant. Not only was the take insulting on so many levels, as Durant said, quote, to me, it was racist, end quote. Here's the thing. LeBron is not going to, quote, shut up and dribble. Nor should he. We would lose out on so much if he did. But listen to why he won't. And what he said after the game when this came up.
I was down courtside. We had a timeout, and all our guys walked to the bench. And I glanced over, and I seen Dr. J, I seen Kareem, I seen Bill Russell, and I seen Jerry West. And I just thanked him. I thanked him. And the Big O is not here, and I thank him too. But, you know, we all know what Kareem and Russell and all those guys went through in a time where whatever they said was like, no. You're not allowed to say that. Shut up and dribble.
Yeah.
And I can't sit here and allow that to happen because of what they went through. And, you know, it would have been the same as telling Jackie Robinson to shut up and to slide in the home base.
Yeah.
Or Jesse Owens to shut up and just go triple jump. I can't do that because there's so many people that's looking up to me and there's so many that's going to come after me. So, you know, I got to continue the path.
You know, so as he points out, there's quite the tradition of people in this country saying that athletes should do more and simultaneously telling athletes to shut up and dribble. If a plumber has political opinions, nobody says to the plumber, shut up and fix the pipes. And while that should never be said to any athlete, because it's never said to anyone in any other profession outside of entertainment, it truly should never be said to LeBron. Because while he may not have a college degree, few people in this country have done more with less than LeBron. In many ways, LeBron is the embodiment of the American dream. Coming from a very difficult background to the top of his chosen field and having started multiple businesses in other fields. That's not dumb luck. That's smart work. That's hard work. But here's where the argument that LeBron James should just shut up and dribble really falls apart. Because if LeBron were to just shut up and dribble, there wouldn't be the LeBron James Family Foundation. And without the LeBron James Family Foundation, there wouldn't be the I Promise program that engages 1,200 at-risk students in Akron, Ohio. And if LeBron James would just, quote, shut up and dribble, there wouldn't be $41 million for full-ride scholarships at the University of Akron for students who go through his foundation's I Promise program. You see, countless futures are being changed because LeBron will not just shut up and dribble. You may not like his game. You may not like his politics. You may not like how he acts. But you have to respect this guy. You might feel more comfortable if LeBron would, quote, just shut up and dribble. But the league and the country would be a worse place if he did. AJ Hinch is my guest. AJ, it's always good to talk to you. How are things?
Life is good, Jim. I like that intro, especially when you said 2017 World Series champs. We've had quite an off season, and now we started camp, first full squad today. and we're off and running.
You know, I was going to ask you about that offseason because it's got to be an offseason different than any other because you are world champions. But what about camp? AJ, pitchers, catchers reported last week. You've got your first full squad workout scheduled for today. So what's the mood and the vibe like in West Palm Beach right now?
Well, it's pretty good. You know, we return almost our roster in its entirety. We added a couple of relievers, Joe Smith, Hector Rondon, and then Justin Verlander comes back for his first full season with us, and Garrett Cole gets traded over here. So a couple new names, but the bulk of our team is already made. It remains the same, and it's interesting to have a team like that. Like, how do you prepare that team? How do you get that vibe going? And when I walk in the clubhouse, and it feels really good right now coming into camp. They're hungry. They're pretty humble. Now, I will tell you, the garage at Minute Maid has picked up some fancy cars in the postseason. We've been able to enjoy this parade for a couple months, but we're about to put that on in the rearview mirror and start talking about 18 because there's a lot of teams that want to do what we did last year.
AJ Hinch joining us. I know you're ready, but when you talk about the offseason, the fact that maybe there's some nice new cars in the garage. I mean, look, when you win the World Series, you're going to play a lot of extra games, which you did last season. Obviously, that's a good thing. But at the same time, is there any concern about that championship hangover? And if so, have you addressed it, and how do you go about preventing it?
Well, I don't think we know yet because a lot of us haven't gone through this. But I'm going in telling the guys that it's more of a mental thing than a physical thing. I think the physical grind is what it is. And we have an incredible athletic team, you know, led by the MVP and Jose Altuve and Carlos Correa and Bregman and Springer, Keuchel, Verlander. I mean, I've got really good players around the field that can physically get themselves ready. I think the key is mentally whether you can handle all this attention and all this love and all this, this notoriety that comes with this. I mean, a year ago, we have a few fans sprinkled in full squad. Today, it was packed. And that comes with a responsibility to stay hungry and do the little things a little bit better and all the things that spring training's for. We got to prepare ourselves to be ready because if you limp into spring training, you limp into the season, you find yourself at or below 500 a couple months in. And we've watched a couple teams struggle over the years. That's why nobody's repeated since 2000. And we want to be, we want to be a really good team for a really long time, and we're not allowing ourselves that crutch of this hangover physically or mentally.
Astros manager AJ Hinch joining us. You mentioned Justin Verlander. AJ, he said last week, and I quote, "I think the American League goes through us," end quote. Curious, what do you think? You're chuckling now. What do you think when you hear that? I mean, is there a part of you that doesn't need that on a bulletin board, or do you like the feeling that, hey, we are the World Series champions? Of course the American League goes through us.
Yeah. Well, I love it because I think our guys will do what it takes to back it up. I think it's all talk and it's good banter and trash talk, and you you can put anything you want up on the board. You still have to go out and play, and our guys can really understand that. And obviously, we won't be too brash and bold, but we do feel like we have the best team in the league, and we need to go out and prove it. And it's going to be a grind. And I can give you all the sound bites that you want about one game at a time or one series at a time, and that's all really true. We got to play every one of these games to get where we want to get. But to come in with a little swagger, come in with some confidence, more importantly, to go out on the field and put the work in to put ourselves in that position is going to be the key. So, I've seen, everything comes through Houston, and right now we are the world champs, but the games are going to start pretty soon, and some of that feeling or some of that outward trash talk is going to have to start to be on the field. But I love it for the tone to set that's the expectations around here.
AJ, you talked about some of the guys who are going to be back. And when I look at guys like Alex Bregman or George Springer, to name a couple of guys, step up the way they did on the biggest stage, how much does that change them as players?
Well, I think it's going with maturity in the league, and I think that's where Jose Altuve is still in his 20s. He's obviously got a lot of hardware. Alex Bregman's brand new in his career, just having his first complete season. George Springer, World Series MVP, he just reached arbitration, so he's still young in his career. He's got a couple of years left before he hits free agency, and we hope all these guys can stay with us and stay longtime Astros, but as players, they're still developing, and there's something that every one of these guys can do to get a little bit better, to master their craft a little bit, and whether it's an MVP or whether it's, first guy in the league. So
I think the being able to perform at the level we performed at the highest moments with the highest scrutiny and all the attention at Dodger Stadium, at Fenway, at Yankee Stadium, we were able to knock off three really big teams. And I think for the younger players or guys that are in the middle of their their careers, I think it's a confidence booster that there are no higher games that we're going to play. There are no more pressure packed situations than an elimination game against the Yankees or an elimination game against the Dodgers in Game 7. I mean, we can perform in that one. We can certainly perform in a random game anytime during the season and lead to the playoffs.
No doubt. Astros manager A.J. Hinch joins us for a few more moments. You mentioned Gerrit Cole. He comes over. He's one of the new faces in camp. He came over in that deal with the Pirates. What was your reaction when you first heard about that trade?
I was blown away because, I was already starting to think about opening day starter, and Verlander and Keuchel both started opening day last year. You sprinkle in another dude that can do it and has done it the last couple seasons in Pittsburgh. Now you start talking about Lance McCullers and Charlie Morton and Peacock and McHugh, and I was looking down at this list of, we have a chance to roll out a really good starting pitcher every day. When you open up, I guess nowadays it's your app, it's not the paper anymore, right? You open up your app on who's facing who, and right now Gerrit Cole makes our team ridiculously strong in the rotation because it's another frontline starter who's, upper 90s, really good slider. We feel like we can make him a little bit better. And he's embraced coming over to this team and fits in perfectly. So when we got him, I was pretty pumped because of the depth that it was providing. 200 innings in a supposed down year for him in Pittsburgh in the National League. I mean, that's unique given the way that starters come out of the games a little bit earlier nowadays. So it was music to my ears when Jeff called and said, "Hey, we got another pitcher, Gerrit Cole. He's coming. He's we traded for him and the depth, and we got better."
A.J. Hinch joining us. A.J., earlier today, Major League Baseball announced a few changes with regards to the pace of play, including a limit of 6 mound visits per 9 innings, shorter changeovers between innings. What's your reaction when you hear that, and generally, how do you feel about the pace of play right now?
Yeah, I think it's tough to navigate, in one memo or one new rule. I'll be interested to see how it all plays out and whether or not these are just little seconds that we're gathering or whether we're really making a difference with the changes. I mean, we'll play by the rules, and I've got to figure out exactly what does it mean to have a mound visit. They've given some definitions. We're going to meet with MLB next week. I don't think any of us know. I know anything you bring into this game that's different, creates a little bit of a stir, and there's a little bit of a buzz on usually a little bit of an aggressive reaction. So, we've got to let it play out before we really see if it's a difference maker or is it just different. But I think in general, I think guys like Chris play the games that happen. But I also know we played some pretty epic games that lasted a long time last season, both in the regular season and the postseason. So I guess beauty of the sport is in the eye of the beholder. Some people like no time limit, no issues with the pace of play. Let us just kind of navigate the game. And some guys like the speed up rules and trying to keep some of the dead time out of it. So we'll see. I'm not sold on what exactly the impact is going to be, but I know it's important to the commissioner, which so that means we have to play by the rules.
So AJ, take one last look before you go at last season. You and your wife, Erin, were able to share that World Series run with your daughters. What did it mean to have them with you and sharing that experience with them?
It was so awesome. Thanks for asking about that. Because with the exception of, they only went to school. I have two teenage daughters, so they went to school like 6 days the month of October, which for their teachers, they probably were a little bit frustrated. For me, I meant we kept winning. And so I liked having them around and being able to do it. As manager, I spend more time with this team and with these players and coaches than I do them during the season. So to take them to the big cities and having them enjoy the atmosphere, I mean, it was ridiculously fun atmosphere at Fenway and at Yankee Stadium and at Dodger Stadium, and to have them be by the stage and have them see what winning is all about. It was I say it's a once in a lifetime opportunity, but I want it to be a second in a lifetime opportunity this year. So we'll bring them on board if we can get that far again.
Yeah, I was gonna say once in a lifetime, but you're right. Maybe it's not once in a lifetime. Certainly you're not gonna settle for once in a lifetime. And as parents, AJ, haven't we learned that we start off like you cannot miss school, and now thinking is, once in a while, it's okay. You gotta pull them out of school for a once in a lifetime opportunity, right?
No doubt. No, I think you have to live. You have to live life, and some of that comes with, you know, bending the rules a little bit when unique opportunities come up. And I'm glad they were on board, and I'm glad they're all caught up with their schoolwork. And then we'll take them out of school for spring training too. So it's part of the baseball life.
New York Mets skipper Mickey Callaway opened up some eyes when he dropped the quote of the year. Now, on the one hand, if you've spent any time around a Major League Baseball clubhouse or a manager or a pitching coach, this is not an unusual line. What was unusual is it's a line that made it into the mainstream. This is not an unusual line in baseball. And what I'm talking about, in case you missed that story, if you're in New York City, there's no way you could miss that story. But if you missed the story, Mets skipper Mickey Callaway said that when discussing his bullpen, he was not going to overuse his bullpen. And by overuse, he was not going to get guys up to start warming up and have them throw an inordinate amount of pitches in the bullpen and then not get into a game. There is a phrase to describe this that literally every manager who has ever managed has used, but most know better than to get in front of a microphone or a camera with it.
Dry humping guys is something that I feel very strongly about. And
so he feels very strongly about that. In other words, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. We're not going to get guys up and have them sit down and get guys back up and have them do this and waste their arms, waste their pitches. We're just not doing it. He's not about that life. Not for his team, not for his bullpen, not for a pitching staff that got turned inside out by Terry Collins. No more dry humping of his bullpen. And then hopefully he won't use that phrase anymore. He just can't go for that. We know this.
I just don't go for that.
So, apparently somebody did not send the Mets GM, Sandy Alderson, the same memo. I mean, no sooner than the Mick realizes, yeah, I probably shouldn't have said that. I probably shouldn't use that phrase to describe that situation. No sooner than Mick somehow was able to pull himself out of that, Sandy jumps right back into it and rekindles the flames of one of the great dry humps of our time. The Tim Tebow dry hump. Because America's favorite try hard is back in camp with the Mets for a second season in a row. This after setting the world on fire with a combined .222 batting average over nearly 500 plate appearances. So Sandy goes straight-faced to a reporter when he uttered the following words about a potential major league run for Tim Tebow at some point.
Somebody asked me whether I think he'll be a major league player at some point. I think he will play in the major leagues. That's my guess. That's my hope. And to some extent now, after a year and a half, a modest expectation.
God, you remember when this guy was so well-respected with the Oakland A's? I mean, let's go ahead and put that into context for a minute. Let's put into context what's happening in New York as the baseball season arrives. The Yankees spent the offseason putting Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton into the same outfield. There's a legitimate chance the two of these guys could hit 100 or more bombs between just the two of them, or maybe more. The Mets, though, are selling their fans on a 30-year-old who managed to run his bat into 8 big flies in 2 levels of A-ball last year and did it against teenagers and kids in their early 20s when he's a grown-ass man, a 260-pound slab of granite who still takes BP with his hat off, his hair gelled, and didn't completely embarrass himself, so now they've got him on the fast track. I mean, sure, he struck out nearly 30% of the time in his official at-bats last year. But while the Yankees are going all in and swinging trades for the NL MVP, the team right across town has their GM pimping a sideshow, all to sell a couple of more jerseys in a few more towns down on the farm. And look, this is not a knock or a crack back on Tebow. Tebow is having the time of his life. Tebow is brilliant. This guy's getting paid to play baseball terribly. He's turned failing into a well-paid job. into an industry onto itself with another book deal and speaking tour right around the corner, I'm sure. But just when Mickey Callaway sounds like he's hell-bent on turning the Mets into an actual baseball team and not some sideshow, the GM is off-pedaling Tebow. Maybe the last piece of red meat that he's got to sell his fans. Even when he has to know damn well, there's not a shot in hell that guy's ever going to make it to the big leagues. Not unless it's another shameless ploy to get people to show up after the Mets are out of contention and to sell a few more jerseys. I mean, who are you kidding with that? You want to talk about a dry hump.
Dry humping guys is something that I feel very strongly about.
At least your GM does too. Tyler Kepner. Tyler, good to have you back. What's up? How are you?
I'm great, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for the visit. Listen, before we get to baseball, I want to talk to you about your connection to the NBA All-Star Weekend, specifically the dunk contest. More specifically, the fact that you gave up a moonshot to Donovan Mitchell's father in a media baseball game at Citi Field. What pitch did you throw him? Where did it end up?
Oh, man, it ended up, I don't remember if it was, I only have two. I have a curveball and a pretty slow fastball. So I don't remember which it was, but it ended up about eight or nine rows up into the right field Pepsi porch or Coca-Cola porch or whatever it is, way up there. It was the longest home run I've ever given up, and it was foul, but it was pretty cool, honestly, to see come off the bat. And he's a former AAA baseball player. So, I mean, Donovan Mitchell Jr. comes from some pretty good athletic bloodlines. I did hold him to a single, though. So
good man.
After the foul ball.
Way to keep your head. Tyler Kepner joining us. All right, so last week, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred announced that there would be rule changes with respect to the pace of play this season. Earlier today, the league announced that there would be a limit of 6 mound visits per 9-inning game, and they're looking to tighten up the breaks between innings. I talked to A.J. Hinch about this. What's your reaction to the changes?
Yeah, it was funny. I was over at Astros camp today, actually. So I talked to Verlander about it. He was not happy about it at all, Justin Verlander. I mean, you know, then again, his catcher, Brian McCann, didn't seem to think it was a big deal. He said, we just need to prepare more before games. We prepare a lot anyway, so it's no big deal. But Verlander was talking about getting crossed up with a catcher. And yes, there's a provision in that where the catcher can say, hey, I don't want to see, I'm on, you know, a different page here with my pitcher for the signs. I need to go out. So baseball, I think, tried to account for that. But pitchers don't like to be told what to do. Their whole job is to initiate the action and to be the one who starts. Nothing can start without them. And to be told that you can't consult with your catcher, that's going to ratchet up the paranoia that they have in one sense, or just the fact that, you know, they want to be in control and they want to know precisely what they're doing at all times. And any limit on that is going to cause a major problem with a lot of pitchers.
Well, that makes sense. But if they're upset about that, what's going to happen if and when there's the arrival of a 20-second pitch clock? How likely is that there will be a pitch clock in Major League Baseball at some point in the near future? Because there has been talk.
Yeah, I think there will be because, I mean, it's good in the sense now that, they held off on it because that would have really upset a lot of players. But, Jim, I just don't see the way baseball is being played now that you're really going to shave off many minutes, if any, from the game. They can talk about pace of action, which Manfred likes to talk about, but it really comes down to the time of the games. And every time there's a short game, guarantee there are not a lot of walks, and not a lot of pitching changes, and not a lot of pitches thrown. I mean, it's just basic math. The fewer pitches, the shorter the game is. And nowadays, guys get paid for taking pitches, showing plate discipline, wearing down the pitcher, and pitchers strike out a ton of guys. Every strikeout is at least 3 pitches, if not more. So more pitches means a longer game, and that's what baseball is geared for now, home runs and strikeouts with the velocity and power. So I don't think the time of game is going to go down no matter what they do with these changes today.
Tyler Kepner, New York Times baseball writer, national baseball writer for that newspaper. Tyler, really curious move, I thought, between the Padres or the decision by the Padres to sign Eric Hosmer to that 8-year deal. What do you make of that fit for both him and the team?
Well, with a guy like Hosmer, he's young enough to where you can kind of justify it. He turned 28 in October, so theoretically he should have a few more years left of his prime. I worry for the Padres' sake that the best years of this deal will be the ones before they become real contenders, because they don't have the pitching to contend this year. I mean, let's be honest. But But they were a little better last year than most people thought they'd be, and there is something going on down there. They've gathered some good pieces in these trades. AJ Preller knows what he's doing, and Hosmer is a leader kind of guy. There's definitely something to that. We saw him in the big stage in Kansas City, and he's a really good player. He's a good defensive player. I don't know how much of a big impact difference-making offensive player he is, but he did hit 25 home runs last year in a big ballpark. So I think it's a good signing for Hosmer, and I think it's okay for the Padres. I think the Padres need to take a step up at some point. They can't always be rebuilding. They tried a few years ago with all those big trades, didn't work out. And I like it when a team tries to, shed, it's been an also-ran for a long time in San Diego. You know, it's time to do something. And Hosmer's a good guy. He's a reliable kind of person in that clubhouse, and he is pretty reliable on the field. But for that money, I maybe would have, expected maybe more of a home run RBI type. But with the age and the leadership and the reliability, it's a solid play, I think.
Tyler Kepner, my guest. Now, you had a piece last week about Derek Jeter and what he's doing with the Marlins. Now, when this guy retired, he was a beloved icon. He could have stayed that beloved icon. He could have spent time on the golf course, and that legend probably would have grown larger and larger. Instead, he joins the Marlins, and now we see what's happening. And, the beating, frankly, that his reputation is taking. Why do you think that he made that move?
Yeah, that was the central question I wanted to ask, when I got down there to, sit with him one-on-one, because I covered him for so long in New York. And he really has a more perfect legacy, if you can say that, than probably any other player. Just totally spotless. And he had what seems to be a really great, comfortable life that he had earned for himself. But to take on the Marlins, of all teams,
right.
With all those complications with that fan base and the stadium and the history there and the payroll and just what a mess it was when Jeffrey Loria sold it, that's a big challenge for someone who'd never been in that position before. But he wanted it. He said he wanted to, he always wanted to give back to the game in a way. But he always did want to be an owner. And he said, look, you can't pick when and where these teams pop up. This was the team that was open. He does live in Florida. Now, he can't commute from Tampa. He realized that pretty quickly. He has to live in Miami because he's not a ceremonial guy. He's going to do it. He's going to do the job. He's going to do it right and put in the hours. But it's a huge fixer-upper. And my takeaway from meeting with him, though, is that he's okay with the challenge of it, and he's still the same Jeter in the sense that, he doesn't really care about making a small incremental improvement. He said, what's improvement? I said, well, last year you won 77 games. What about 78? And he was, he was scowling, basically, 78 wins. He's like, come on, you don't buy a team to win 78 games. He's like, it's the same as it always was with me, which is if you don't win a championship, it's a failure. So he wants to win a championship, and he didn't want to win 78 games. He didn't want 82 games. He wants to win the whole thing, and to do that, he feels like he just had to rip off all the Band-Aids at once.
So in terms of the plan, this is a team that's ripped down their roster every time they've won a World Series. So based on your conversations with him, what is his plan right now?
Well, his plan was that, look, this was not a World Series team, and this was not a popular team. This was, the fans who were there can say they liked those players, and I'm sure they did, but it's been last in the league in attendance for 5 years. They had one uptick when they opened the new park. They got all the way to 12th, and then they quickly slipped back to last. It's been a very fickle baseball market that's been burned, you're right, twice. Both championship teams were quickly dismantled, but his point was that this team has never won, hasn't had a winning season with this Stanton, Yelich core group. And he said, look, the pitching was not fixable. He's like, there's not any two pitchers you can tell me I can go out and get that's going to make this team a winner. And he said, determining that this team had no chance, that he might as well trade pretty much everyone. He didn't trade Real Muto or Boer, but he traded the four big guys, Gordon and the three outfielders, because there was not a chance to win, and he was not in the business to come in and, like I said, win 78 games or win 70 games. He might as well win 60 or 58. And he's not conceding that either. He's saying, don't assume we're going to lose. But in baseball right now, it's a problem, right? All these teams tanking. But it is kind of the way the Astros did it, the way the Cubs did it. So he figures he's just got to, rip it all down and tear it up and build it up in the way he envisions.
All right, so speaking of the Astros, before you go, you spent some time with them. And as I mentioned, I had A.J. Hinch on earlier this hour. It's pretty clear Houston is not content with only winning that one World Series. Baseball has not had a repeat champion since the Yankees. How likely is it that the Astros do it?
Well, I was thinking that. I was trying to think of reasons that they shouldn't be picked, you know, to win it again. And I can't think of many. I think they did a really smart job last year in managing these guys' workloads, so they don't return a lot of pitchers who were worn out from last year, which seems to be a theme sometimes is why teams don't repeat. Their pitchers just don't quite have it as much. They have so many young guys in their primes. They really didn't lose anybody from the team. I mean, they lost Beltran and a couple of complimentary pieces, but nobody of major significance is off that roster. I think the safe play is always to pick someone else from the field, but I think if anybody has the best chance, it is probably the Astros, because those pitchers, again, were not terribly worn out last year. They're very, very deep offensively and in pitching, and that's what you need more than ever now. You need depth. It's harder than ever, with no PEDs in the game, I guess, to get through that long schedule. You need depth. The Dodgers had a ton of depth. The Astros had a ton of depth, and they're so far and away better than any team in that division that they should be able to once again use a big division lead to give themselves the rest they need for October.
All right, so this week at the Riv, it was all about one dude. We talked about it going into the tournament. We're talking about it the Monday after the tournament. It was all about one dude. One dude who fell from the top of the world golf rankings all the way down into the deep hundreds. A dude with multiple majors who recently contemplated retirement for health reasons. A dude who was beloved, extremely popular, but had not won a tournament in a long, long time. Now, don't get this twisted. This is not about Elgato. This is about Bubba Watson. Because the 6'3" lefty with the pink driver actually stuck around for the weekend. The spinal-fused tournament host named Eldrick Tont did not. That guy went out. He fired 76 on Friday before trading in his scorecard for another early ticket out of town. So, don't mind me while I talk about the winner and not somebody who played as much golf, tournament golf, as I did on Saturday and Sunday. Bubba is worth talking about. Bubba, a few years back, was a two-time green jacket winner and one of the best on tour. But that was then. This is now. He's been ice cold and MIA for the last couple of seasons. But it all changed yesterday. When he stared down the back nine at Riviera, he didn't blink. Three birds in his last eight holes, including this dagger from a greenside bunker on the par 3 14th.
Just needs to get it out of the bunker. Gravity will take over.
Oh, yeah. Bubba Watson makes it two at the 14th. And a two-shot lead.
Call it, baby. Call it.
Thanks to CBS for that. You know, Riv often gets compared to Augusta National because of the creativity and the imagination it takes to get around that track and win. And as we know, when he's on, nobody is more creative than Bubba, who was shaping banana shots over opposite fairways, bending them right to his spot. So it's no wonder that this dude is a three-time winner at the Riv, a two-time winner at the Masters, something only Ben Hogan has done before him. And then how's this for some serious deja vu? 4 years ago yesterday, I had Bubba on this show right after he had won for the first time at Riviera. And I asked him then, what's it like to win at such a historic track?
There's a lot of history at Riviera. Any win on tour is good, but is there something about Riviera that makes it a little more special?
Oh, for sure. It's a venue that we don't change much. You know, they haven't added too much length. They haven't added new greens, new bunkers. They left the history there, and that's what I love. That's what most of us tour players love. We love that going back and seeing the same thing. We can see where the great players have hit shots from. We've seen where great players have made putts from. And so for me, I mean, it was an honor and a thrill to have my name somewhere associated around that tournament now and some of the bigger names that I never got to meet, never got to watch play golf. For me, it's a dream come true to be part of that venue and about some of the great names there.
Bubba on this show when he last won it. Crazy that 4 years and a day, 4 years and a day later, that he'd win for a third time. And when you saw him roll in that par in 18 yesterday, the emotions overcame him because, frankly, he probably didn't know if he was ever going to win any tournament again.
It means a lot. My goal has always been to get 10 wins, and so this got to my 10th win. There's so many emotions going through my head right now. Never know if you're going to play good again. Never know if you're going to be able to lift a trophy again. So many things. I thought about retirement. I mean, there's just so much stuff going through my head right now. I can't believe I'm going to lift a trophy here in a second.
Good for him. I mean, this week's set up to be all about somebody else's comeback, another guy's comeback. Then Bubba steals the headlines when he ripped laser shot after laser shot and once again conquers the Riv. Something the other guy has not done even once. If I'm Bubba, I can't wait to get to Georgia in April. If I'm the Cat, I can't wait to get to the range and the practice green and the simulator and the track man and anything else that's going to help me flip 76s into 67s. Jim, when are you going to talk about the photo? It's on 12 wood. I don't know, wood. When are you going to do another scope? Friday night, probably, right? All right, so he's talking about the photo. We all know the photo he's talking about. We're talking about Hawk's photo. Tiger's trip to Riviera ended pretty much the way that I would have expected it to, early. Now, again, I had an open mind. I was positive going into the event. I actually had some sort of expectations for him, and then he made me look bad. Should have gone with my gut, or my head, actually. So I thought he would do better than he did. And I was fine with him shooting that opening round 72. I thought, you know what, there might be something here. This guy's not going to win the tournament, but he might make it to Saturday, but he didn't. But the guy who, even in his prime, who would get eaten alive by Riv, was not getting to the weekend when he was spraying that big dog 30 yards deep again. This guy's never going to win anything at all if he can't play it off the tee. And he was just grinding to salvage pars. Something he could not do anywhere near as well on Friday as he did on Thursday. But while the Cat spent the weekend at home, the Hawk spent the weekend at Riv. And if it's possible, the Sparrow set a new low for representing me, this show, and even himself. Because if it weren't embarrassing enough that the executive producer of my program has been washing up Tiger's Bridgestones, he goes full-fledged golf loser when he reaches across the rope line for a high five, a legitimate high five. If you're watching on CBS Sports Network, you see it. If not, go to Hawk's timeline because you know I'm not putting it on mine. He reaches across the rope for a high five, a legitimate high five from Rory McIlroy, who hits Hawk with the Heisman and maybe the greatest stink eye ever. If you have not seen the tweet, check what Hawk posted over the weekend. A picture that says 1,000 words, and every last one of them clowning and killing Hawk. Now, this is not the first time I've had to say this. I'm sure it's not going to be the last time I have to say this. My reputation, my integrity, my cred, all very important to me. My EP, executive producer. In fact, an extension of myself. Only this extension is like some cat-tatted moron who finds new and incredible ways to embarrass me. And don't think that I'm just doing this on the air. Trust me, we've had this talk off the air already. But now I'm doing it for all of your benefit because you weren't here for that conversation. Check out the wardrobe on this guy as he's roaming the grounds of one of the nicest country clubs on the PGA Tour. Look at what this guy's wearing. A puke yellow hat, representing a basketball team in Seattle that has long since been killed off. A shirt inspired by a grandmother's wallpaper. Jorts. Calf-high black socks over some hipster boat shoes that make his pale twig legs look even more pale. Hawk, you're lucky they let you anywhere near that track. Hell, you're lucky Rory didn't suplex you or put security on your ass. The freaking Sparrow. This is a guy who has been talking nonstop about this weekend for months. This is all this guy's been talking about. He even flew his mom into town to help with his daughter so he could follow his beloved Gatto around the track. Never for one second thinking that maybe Eldrick was at best a coin flip shot at making the weekend, considering he had to grind his ass off just to make the cut at Torrey, a place that he owns and loves. So while part of me is thankful that Eldrick did not make the cut, I'd have to fire Hawk if they hit him with a taser for freaking out when he got within eye shot of Elgato. Even when Tiger isn't out there, he's making a fool of himself. Hell, Julio Jones thought reaching for a high five from Rory was embarrassing. At least give Justin Thomas some love. At least he's been in the jungle a couple of times. Another week, another embarrassing moment for my EP. And another day where I have to weigh the pros and cons of letting this guy be a part of my crew and then sift through Twitter, trying to get through it all to get back on track with the program. All right, so just to give you a sense of some of the reaction on Twitter to Hawk. I mean, Hawk's problem is now he just keeps thinking, what do I do to up the bar? How do I up the bar? I've already gotten ink of my cat. Now I've gone to a PGA Tour event and got a picture of Rory McIlroy looking like he wants to fight me. I mean, Hawk, what do you do next? Where is there to go from here? See the reaction. And Mark the Nomad tweets, my word, Hawk, that outfit. Have you given up? Look at Jim Benton, the oldest of the old school. James Kelly, like 20 years before James Kelly. Benton. Benton might have been the first unofficial, I don't want to say employee of the program because that's not true. But I mean, Benton was James Kelly before James Kelly, Stucknut before Stucknut. Benton was here almost from day one. He tweets, Bill Belichick on a beach thinks that's a bad look. And Pauly T. Wall tweeting about Hawk. Quote, Hawk, help me out here. How would you describe your style? Seems like it's one of those intentional, countercultural, dumpy style things. But that's just my guess. Please advise. Thanks. Hey, did that exceed 140? That looks like that exceeded 140. I'm not saying that what he said is not true. Hey, stay on that, y'all. Stay on that, y'all. Count that up for me. That looks long. At Total Big E tweets, you should let the wife dress you from now on, pigeon. Dude, how'd you get out of the house looking like that? Yeah, go ahead. What do you have to say for yourself, Hawk? I know nothing good.
What's up, Jam? How are you?
Stop asking me things like that. What do you have to say for yourself?
Well, first off, we got an early start because it was Huntington Beach to Santa Monica.
Oh, so you got dressed in the dark, so you have no idea what you were wearing.
No, I knew what I was wearing, but my wife was asleep, so she didn't know what I was wearing.
Okay, right.
And golf is this weird sport where the spectators dress
not
like
as weird as you're making it, Hawk.
That's true, but the spectators dress like they're going to get on the course at some time and start hitting the ball themselves. It's a terrible look where they wear like shorts and a polo tucked in with the Titleist hat and the baggy sunglasses. So I go for my own skis.
There's not a muni in the world that would let you play golf dressed like that.
That's right. So that's why I'm saying the other spectators dress like they're about to jump on the course. I like to go the opposite direction.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And, right. You know, I was looking to make a statement and...
Well, you did, Hawk.
Thank you very much. I take that as a compliment. And
You shouldn't. It was not meant as a compliment.
I followed Rory around the entire back nine. I was hitting him every hole. Rory, what's up? What's up? And finally, my friend decided to cross the other side of the ropes and take a picture of me getting denied by Rory. That was like the third time that day. What you don't see before the picture is Rory looks at me and then immediately looks away. He wanted nothing to do with me. I also saw Justin Thomas, who I hit with a Team Crunchy peanut butter blast. Which he appreciated. He looked back, he smiled, he nodded. And then Pattisauer from Bugaha ran into me because he recognized the shirt from an earlier tweet. So I ran into him on about the 12th hole.
Wait, you're talking really quickly and covering a lot of ground. Pattisauer was here.
Yeah, he...
From Bugaha.
Yes, he now lives in the Los Angeles area. This was his second time at the Riv. He was there with a buddy.
There goes the neighborhood.
Right, exactly. So we met up and got some beers and hung out and...
You slammed beers with Pattisauer.
I mean, he slammed the beers. I slow-sipped one between 13 and 18 because I had a long drive ahead of me, and I was being responsible no matter how bad it looked out there.
Right.
And the first question he asked was, how do I get on the podcast? To which I told
him. That's a pretty easy question to answer. It's never happening.
Right.
Ever.
I said, Jim says you're never getting on, and I double-checked that with you to make sure that was still true. But we had a good time. And may I please say this, the Riviera, the most spectator-friendly course in all of golf.
Obviously, they let you on.
Exactly. Beautiful course, easy to walk, easy to see everything. It was an amazing time.
You know why? Because your dude Elgato wasn't there.
That's true. The gallery was one-tenth the size that it was, so I got a lot of mobility. Bad for Rory, good for me. A lot of fun. Would do it again.
Yeah,
can't
dude,
wait
horrific,
till next time.
Horrific for me and my brand that I'm working so hard to build up. You understand this, right?
Yes, and I did mean to tell you that. Wherever I go, I always have you in the back of my mind, which is why I didn't ask to get credentialed. I didn't wear anything that said I was a member of the media. I was like, I got to keep Jim out of this.
But the problem is, dude, even if you don't have that credential around your neck, you still represent me. Even if you're not a credentialed working stiff that day, you still, when you leave the house, you represent me. As long as you pull a paycheck from me, you represent me. You understand that?
I do. But
didn't 5 seconds ago until I explained it to you.
Can we meet halfway? I'm not going to yell, get in the hole. I'm not going to swear. I'm not going to get drunk, but I am going to dress like an idiot and I am going to try to get some high fives.
Halfway is stop leaving the house while you work for me looking like that. And mostly at sporting events, or especially at sporting events. That's halfway. You want to meet halfway? Meet me halfway in the hallway where I can fire you so we don't do it on the air. Come on, Hawk. Stop negotiating your alleged hipsterness. There's nothing hip about that, all right? Stop doing it.
No promises, but thank you. I will take it under advisement. You've given me a lot of room to be
here.
I've
given you your whole life, Hawk. What are you talking about?
And it's much appreciated. And I will try to correct my wardrobe and my antics, but there are no promises.
All right, so I'm going to take that as I'm not changing anything, and you should take this as your 30-day probationary period. Get it together, Hawk.
You got it.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you for nothing. Meanwhile, the tweets keep coming. Hawk ain't changing for nothing. He's not. This is the money that he spent when he went to the Salvation Army and bought all those clothes, and this is what he's going to wear. There you go. You know I appreciate you, clones, and I know you will appreciate Podcast Tuesday. My conversation with David Goggins is in the can. It's amazing. Catch you then. See you next time. I'm out.